Welcome to Illinois Family Spotlight, a conversation about issues of the day from a biblical perspective, as well as highlights from interviews, conferences, and events.
Hey guys, it's Jenna. Thank you so much for tuning in to this edition of Illinois Family Spotlight. You are in for the second session, or at least the first part of the second session, that Dr. George Barna gave us at the Illinois Family Institute's Worldview Conference this past March. You're going to be hearing right now from IFI Board President Richard Hardian, who is going to be introducing what Dr. Barna is going to be speaking on.
We are grateful to have Dr. George Barna back with us this afternoon. He'll speak on cultural transformation through biblical discipleship. I'm going to take no more time so we get all Dr. Barna. Please welcome back Dr. George Barna.
All right, so during the course of this session, I want us to think about the fact that these days most people say the country's on the wrong track, we're moving in the right direction, things aren't going the way that we think they should. Why is that? Why is the country not on the right track? Well, we have to go back and try to figure out how did it get there. And the way it got there is by the accumulation of the decisions that Americans made. So if we don't like where the culture is, it's our fault, because it's simply responding to our choices, our decisions, our preferences. And so the good news is, well, the bad news is we're where we're at because obviously we made a lot of bad choices. But the good news is, because the culture is simply a response to our accumulation of choices and decisions, we can change that. If we change our choices, we change the culture. And the more that we can influence other people to change their choices, the more quickly that kind of change can take place. And obviously what we want to have happen is that we bring a biblical worldview into all of those conversations, all of those decisions that are being made, so that the choices are better choices. I would suggest to you that part of the problem that we have is that there aren't enough disciples of Jesus participating in the development of our culture. First of all, we don't have that many disciples. I'll show you numbers in just a moment. But secondly, a number of those disciples believe that or are acting as if getting involved in what's taking place in the culture would dirty them. When in point of fact, that's exactly where disciples are meant to be, in the middle of the fight, right in the midst of all the chaos and the turbulence and the indecision and the bad decisions. That's where we need to be. And the only reason we need to be there isn't because we're smarter, we're more capable, we're more competent. Hopefully it's because we're disciples of Jesus and therefore we're bringing the mind of Christ into the midst of what's going on in the culture. And by bringing him there, we have hope for the culture. And so what I want to do, this is a shorter session. It was meant to be a shorter session. It may not be by the time I'm done, but I've never done this one before, so we'll see what happens. This could go on for hours. The reality here is that biblical discipleship is the antidote to the collapse of American culture, just as it's the antidote to the collapse of every culture around the world. But we've got to deal with American culture first. And so I want to address four questions. How does a culture collapse? How can biblical discipleship restore a broken culture? What produces effective disciple making? And what can you do to be an agent of biblical transformation? So I think to do justice to these four questions, normally I would spend roughly a semester doing it. And I've got right now a little bit less than 30 minutes. So here we go. Those are our four questions. Let's look at, how does a culture collapse? There really are four primary ways that cultures collapse. Morals and values erode, and then you've got relationships, connections, community, that begins to fail or fall apart. Social institutions lose the public trust and confidence, and spirituality, biblical spirituality, weakens and degenerates. And you put those four things together simultaneously, and you've got four parallel tracks for how a culture is decimated. So let's talk first of all about what's going on in America related to morals and values. If we were to look at one of the most important things, I think it's, in terms of values, the most important thing for us, truth. And what we know is that in America today, most people rely upon multiple sources of truth, which right away tells you they don't believe there's any one correct source of truth. I would say there's one real source of truth. That's the Bible. Why the Bible? Because it came from God. God is truth. And what he did was he dictated that to us in written form because he knows we're a bunch of ninnies. And so he had to put it on paper for us. And so we can go back to it and figure things out. Most Americans, more than 4 out of 5 Americans, do not believe that. What we know is that 3 out of 4 Americans today would say that the most trustworthy source of truth for their life is their feelings. Can you imagine a less trustworthy source of truth than feelings? And yet that's what 3 out of 4 Americans. And by the way, the percentages are higher the younger you go in the culture. So we really have our work cut out for us. 2/3 of Americans say there's no such thing as absolute moral truth. About 6 out of 10, when you question them on their truth views, what you find is that they have conflicting views that they buy into. And just because I'm from New York City and we love to get in people's face, what I tend to do is ask people, well, how do you reconcile these two things? They're conflicting with each other. It doesn't make sense. And usually what you get is, huh, how about that? You know, and then if you push them a little bit more and they say, well, you know, but it really feels right. I can't tell you how many times I've heard that. So we've got truth issues here. Only about 1 out of 5 Americans say that they consistently rely upon the Bible to determine truth in their life. We can look at morals. We know that most people, it's actually now less than half, most people do not believe that they're sinners. What we find is that only 2% of Americans believe that they're going to go to hell when they die. What we know is that if you look at there are about a dozen moral behaviors that we track regularly, and Americans choose the immoral path more often than not. We could look at various morals that we look at. You've got half or more of the population saying that abortion, sexual lust, cheating on your taxes, getting drunk, gambling, working on the Sabbath, drug abuse, unmarried sex, use of pornography, about half or more, all would say that those are perfectly morally acceptable. And by the way, if I were to show you the numbers among people who regularly attend Christian churches, the numbers would not be terribly different. There are a couple of issues there where they'd be different. Most of those issues, they're virtually identical. We can look at worldview. We started to look at that last session. Let me give you a different spin on it this time. Let's look ahead to the year 2035. What are we projecting based on what we've been seeing? Because I've been measuring these things for more than 30 years. And so what we're projecting is that syncretism will continue to grow. Biblical theism is probably going to drop from its current 4% to somewhere in between 1 and 2%. We've got increasing belief in reincarnation, karma, the Wiccan idea that, or satanic idea that you can do anything you want as long as it doesn't harm anybody. And we are seeing slow growth in some of the other atheistic, unbiblical worldviews, but it's very slow growth. They're not really our challenge. They're putting ideas in the marketplace that people are warming up to, and over the course of time, they begin to buy into it. But syncretism really is the issue. We do a bunch of research with young people, and if you were to look at teenagers and people in their 20s and do a mind dump of what's in there, this is kind of how they view the world. This is how they think. And so when we talk about this is what we're going to have to fight, you know, feelings are the basis of all their decisions. They don't feel they have any sense of purpose in life. Therefore, they lack motivation. You look at, they do buy into the karmic idea. You get what you deserve, which, of course, is anathema to what Christianity is about. The beauty of being a Christian, if you haven't realized, if you feel okay with karma, don't. Because the beauty of being a Christian is Jesus died so I don't get what I deserve. And so the whole notion of karma falls apart right away. You've got, most of them would say, we're in, by the way, the first period of time in American history, as best I can tell, where a majority of Americans do not believe in the God of the Bible. We just fell under the 50% mark 2 years ago, and it's going to continue to go down for a while. You know, so you've got all of these kinds of things. Why do I put this up there? Because we're trying to figure out how is our culture falling apart. This is part of it, understanding what's going on in the minds and the hearts and the souls of young adults in particular. All right, let's move on to community and relationships. How are they failing? We know that trust in other people has fallen precipitously in the last 40 years. We're at a place now where we don't know our neighbors. We don't know who those people are. We don't spend any time with them, even if we know their name. On average, we find that the typical American says they have 3 or 4 close friends. But as we've tracked that, what we've also found is those close friends change every 3 to 5 years. And so who you're close to today, you probably won't even be associating with 5 years from now. And so, again, there's this sense of isolation, this lack of community that you have. And think about your churches. There's tremendous turnover in churches. And, you know, some of us in the old guard, I mean, we've been in our churches for a long time, but younger people, they keep looking for a better show. And so, you know, it's a difficulty trying to establish even Christian community. We could look at marriage. Marriage as an institution is in trouble. And I say that because we know that even though about 7 out of 10 young adults say they want to get married, less than half of them are likely to actually do so. Currently, it's at about 47%. When they do marry, they're marrying later, and about half, just less than half of those marriages will wind up in divorce. We know that a vast majority of them, about 3 out of 4, cohabited prior to getting married, not only with the person they wind up marrying, but with a series of other people before that. And so, again, that changes the whole nature and dynamic of the relationship. We know that not only is marriage struggling, but family itself is being redefined. It used to be that we looked forward to having children. We were proud of having children. We saw that as perhaps the major commitment in our life other than our commitment to Christ. And yet that's no longer the case. What we know now is that a decreasing number of Americans even want to have children. Currently, only 45% of childbearing age women say that they would like to have children if they haven't had them. Sex without marriage, not a problem to most Americans. The idea behind it is as long as I feel like I love this person or I'd like to hang out with them for a while, then it's legitimate. I don't have to worry about it. I'm not using them. Americans, as a consequence of all of these things, are not even having enough children to repopulate the nation. We need 2.1 children per family or per household to repopulate the country. We're at 1.6. Most of the developed countries in the world are below the replacement rate, but we've actually been dropping pretty quickly. We can look at the whole idea of parenting. I just got to touch on it. Most theologically identified born-again Christian parents are not raising their children to have a biblical worldview. There's no way anybody else would be. So we've got that problem. We have parents outsourcing the raising of their children. So they're really being raised by the culture more than they're being raised by a family.
This is an Illinois Family Institute, illinoisfamily.org update.
According to a new Gallup poll, confidence in higher education has fallen dramatically. from 57% in 2015 to just 38% today. Americans cite rising costs, political agendas, and concerns that students aren't being adequately prepared for the workforce as major reasons for their declining confidence. As Christians, we should care deeply about education because ideas have consequences. They shape hearts and minds, influence families, and ultimately determine the direction of our nation. That's why it's so important that the next generation is grounded in the unchanging truth of God's word, not the ever-shifting ideologies of our culture. Parents, churches, Christian schools, homeschools all have vital roles to play in discipling young people with a biblical worldview. Visit IllinoisFamily.org.
One thing I didn't get to talk about was our research with children, where we asked them about their parents having spiritual influence on them. And one of the most important things that we uncovered in that research was the finding that most children in America today under the age of 13 say that they do not trust their parents. And we asked, well, what does that mean? Why do you say that? And they say, well, I know my parents love me. I know they care about me, but they try to teach me a lot of different things, a lot of principles for life, but they tell me these things, but then I watch them and they do something completely different. I said, well, what does that mean to you? What difference does that make to you? They said, well, it means to me they're probably just as confused as I am. And, I appreciate their efforts, but I'm just going to take their ideas into consideration along with all the other ideas that are given to me, because clearly they haven't figured out what matters or how to live yet either. And so that lack of trust is undermining parents' ability to help develop the biblical worldview of children. Modeling is absolutely crucial if you want to have a real impact on children. We can look at social institutions and what's going on there. Every few years we do a national study where we look at 15 major social institutions, and only one of those is currently trusted by at least one-third of the public, trusted a great deal, only one. Now, that's very different than when I started this. I started actually in politics but years and years ago as a campaign manager and a political pollster. And back then, social institutions, back in the late 70s, early to mid 80s, people trusted them. We thought, yeah, they're made up of good people like me, and therefore, you know, they're trying to do the right thing. That's no longer the perspective that people have, no matter which of those institutions we look at. We can look at the fact that even churches, which is one of the 15 institutions that we study regularly, they've lost a great deal of confidence. Only one out of every six adults has a great deal of confidence in churches in America today. We can look at the single most influential institution, the media. And this is an interesting one because on the one hand, people say, I know I can't trust the media. They don't tell the truth. And then they, and in addition to that, they say, and I don't let them influence me. And then when we try to figure out through our conversations with them, well, how did you get that idea? How did you land on that principle? Why do you carry out that behavior? And we keep tracing it back. It turns out it came from the media. So they're hugely influenced by the media. They think they're not, which in some ways is worse. And for something that we say we know we can't trust, the average adult in America has 13 hours worth of exposure to media messages every single day. 13 hours. We get more input from media than everything else in our life combined. And so we've got to be very intentional about what we're going to do in that regard. Let's look at the last area of spirituality. What we know is Christianity in America is definitely losing ground. In 1995, just 30 years ago, 80% of Americans called themselves Christians. They weren't necessarily, but that's what they thought of themselves as. And now it's dropped to 67%, and it's continuing to drop every few years. We lose another couple of percentage points. we can look at how we're faring against other faith groups. And what we find is that almost every other faith group, including the no faith group, is growing considerably. This is, by the way, the other chart was last 30 years. This chart is just last 5 years. So you can see how quickly things are changing in our culture. And people now are gravitating toward what I would call designer faiths, a lot of smaller faiths that aren't well known, but they become comfortable with what they're about. And so when we look over here at minor faiths, that's the kind of thing we're talking about. We can look at the fact that a biblical worldview is rare. We've talked a lot about that. I think this was an interesting chart, because if you're trying to get one picture of the profile of the church in America and Christianity in America, this would be one that I would put up for grabs. So you look at the number of people who call themselves Christians, 67%. How many go to church regularly, by which we label that once or more a month, which is not terribly often, but using that, it drops down to 36%. How many people never attend a church service? 41%. First time in America's history those two have been flipped. Then you look at how many theologically born-again Christians do we have, theologically defined born-again Christians. And again, that's people who say they know that they will go to heaven after they die, but it's only because they've confessed their sins to Jesus Christ and they're relying upon him to stand up for them. That's down to 34%. This other category, the don'ts, people who don't know if God exists, don't believe that God exists, or don't care if God exists. That now exceeds the number of born-again Christians in America. Again, a first in our history. And then we look at the proportion who have a biblical worldview. I've shown you data on that. But look at this bottom one now. You remember in the first session I gave you the six things that Jesus said about what makes somebody a disciple. If you operationalize those in a survey to figure out how many people meet the six criteria, you're at 3% of the adult population in America. 3%. Now, two things I'll point out. Number one, it's smaller than the number of people with a biblical worldview. Well, it would have to be, because you can't really be a disciple unless you have a biblical worldview. They're very close. That means some people may be gravitating toward becoming disciples. I pray that's the case. But that's why those numbers like that. The other thing, some people say, Barna, you're always so discouraging. I've been accused of having the gift of discouragement. But I think you're misreading this. If you read Scripture, how does God change a culture? Go back and read through the Old Testament. Look at every single city, town, province, kingdom, all the different places that God radically changed. What did he do? He went there. He found the disciples. And what did he do? He put most of them on the sidelines, and he used a small number of that group. It's a group that Scripture calls the remnant. God doesn't need a majority to change any culture. In fact, God doesn't want us thinking that it's because of us that things change, okay? We are his agents of transformation. He is the engine of transformation. And so he's the one who's going to be the transforming if we're available to him. So never be discouraged by numbers like that 3%. All that means is, you know what? God's got some people here ready to do his work. And that's all he needs. And I hope and pray that you are one of them. All right, so we can also look at future expectations for Christianity. It's likely to continue shrinking. The image is taking a beating in the process. And people of no faith are probably going to continue to grow. Now, am I suggesting that God cannot bring about renewal in the church that then leads to revival in the culture? No, God can do that anytime he chooses. And it may happen today, it may happen next week, it may happen a year from now, it may not happen in our lifetime. That doesn't exempt us from the calling to be agents of transformation in that culture. So let's look at discipleship, biblical discipleship. And I'm going to keep calling it biblical discipleship because I think there needs to be a distinction between church-based discipleship and biblical discipleship. Over 80% of the pastors I interview tell me they're doing a great job at growing disciples. Over 80% of the pastors we interview tell us they're doing a great job at biblical worldview development. And then I do the objective research and find we've got 4% with a biblical worldview, 3% who are actually disciples. And so it says to me there's a disconnect there. And so when we're hearing, yeah, churches are really engaged with and doing phenomenal stuff in terms of discipleship, forgive me, I am a skeptic on that. I'm not buying it, okay? Only because of the objective research. I want to buy it. I want to see it. I want to be part of it. I want to see it, you know, change the world. But it's not there yet. It can get there. But how can we restore the culture? Through biblical discipleship. How is it going to restore that culture through biblical discipleship? Well, first of all, you've got to have your philosophy straight and recognize that if you are living a life without Jesus Christ and God's words from the Bible at the center of your life, you are living a failed life. I don't care how much money you're making. I don't care how popular you are. I don't care how comfortable you are. You are living a failed life, and you need to change that. Secondly, proclaiming salvation through Christ to people without then investing yourself in the discipling of that individual is spiritual abuse. I can't tell you how many people I've seen and worked with who are great at proclaiming the gospel. The person raises their hand, says the prayer, comes to the altar, whatever, and we basically abandon them after that point. We say, okay, you know, it's all here for your taking. No, no. If you're going to lead somebody to the Lord, you lead them into being a disciple as well. It's critical that you finish the job, not just start the job. Now, if you don't have the capacity to do that, that's okay. When Billy Graham would go into a town, he wasn't going to stay around for the next 3 or 4 years discipling all the people that came forward, but he made the effort to make sure that there were churches that were committing to doing that. And so if you can't do it, team up with somebody who is a great discipler and make sure that they're then introduced to that person who accepted the Lord and that they're going to take things from there. And you might want to hang around too and figure out how that works. I'd suggest to you also that if you are a disciple and you are not currently discipling somebody or it's not part of your lifestyle to make disciples, you're not a disciple, because that's what disciples do. Keep this in mind. The only people who can create disciples are disciples. Why? Because you can only give what you have. If you don't have what it takes to be a disciple, you're not going to be able to bring other people into that. Disciples reproduce themselves. Okay? Now, the scary part, and I want you to think about this for your church and other churches you know, is that everybody reproduces who they are. And so when we look at churches where most people are not disciples, and up front we're telling them, go out, reproduce yourselves, and then we wonder why the churches aren't making any difference, it's because they did exactly what we asked them to do. They reproduce themselves, they are not disciples, now we have more people who aren't disciples. Now, that's an opportunity if we understand it that way, but we normally don't. We normally celebrate the numbers and say, look what we did, and we leave it there. So you've got to get the whole picture in mind about what's going on here. Ultimately, what we want to do is biblical discipleship because that renews and it strengthens our connection to God and his truth, which is the only real truth, which then in turn impacts our values, our morals, our beliefs, our relationships, all those things that represent the collapse of a society. Yeah, biblical discipleship addresses those. It facilitates supportive relationships. It gives us a greater sense of purpose and what constitutes meaningful and successful performance. And ultimately, it gives us an irrefutable standard by which to judge ourselves. I'm hoping that you're going to go back home today and you're going to look at those six factors that Jesus gave us for what makes somebody a disciple, And you're going to look in the mirror and ask yourself, am I that person? And if you're not, to get on track with it is vitally important, not only for your life, but for whose lives you could influence in the future. So given all that, yes, Jesus gave us the authority and the calling. He gave us the definition. And recognize that a disciple is somebody who imitates the master. So you need to be imitating the master, and you need to be leading other people to do that very same thing. But that requires a commitment on your end. It's going to require relationships. It's going to require that you be sensitive to the presence and the power and the leading of the Holy Spirit. Because you don't make disciples. You're not good enough. I'm not good enough. None of us are. It's only God who makes disciples, but he makes them through those people who are fully sold out to him and saying, Lord, change me however you need to so that I can have the kind of positive influence I need to have in my family, in my workplace, in my community, in my church. Every place I go, I want to be a replica of Jesus Christ. I want to be Christ-like, and I want other people to follow that as well. And know this, you've got to make a difficult choice here. You know, it all sounds well and good when I say these things, but know that the moment you decide that you want to be a disciple, that you will commit to being a disciple, and that you are going to try to make as many disciples as you can before you die, that is a declaration of war. You are jumping right to the front lines of the spiritual war that is happening every moment of every day. Most people that attend our churches have no idea what the spiritual war is because they're not warriors for the kingdom. If you make these commitments and you back them up with action, you do everything you can to live a Christ-like life, and then you are trying to bring that Christ-like life into the presence of others so that they'll embrace it, Satan is going to come after you with everything he's got. So you better know that it's not just you that's doing this. It better be God who's doing this through you. Always be in touch with him, in connection with him, relying on his power. You cannot do this alone. But know that that's what you're getting yourself into.
Thank you guys so much for listening to this edition of Illinois Family Spotlight. I hope you tune in next week for the second presentation, or the second half of Dr. Barna's presentation.
For more information about Illinois Family Spotlight, visit ifiaction.org. And to email questions and comments, do so at feedback@ifiaction.org.